I will ask you to take your seat, s'il vous plaît. On va recommencer. Merci de reprendre vos sièges. Voilà, on va reprendre l'exercice du bilan. Our taking stock exercise will now take us to the birthplace of the common law, where the figure of the judge as the central actor of the legal universe emerged, and then to India, where that image was projected and exported, and of course in a very different social context. As our guides for this part of the trip, we have Professors Kate Mallison and Arvind Agrawal. Professor Mallison teaches at Queen Mary University of London. Her main research interests are the judiciary, the legal system, and the constitution. She's currently working on a major project on the politics of judicial independence in Britain's changing constitution. She has an interest in judicial selection processes with a particular focus on the lack of diversity, not only sexual diversity, in the composition of the judiciary and the legal profession. And she has set up an equal justice initiative to monitor and promote developments in judicial appointments and to promote the appointment of equal numbers of men and women on the bench in the UK. So an activist, again, as well as an academic. Professor Agrawal is a sociologist. He is the Dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences at the Central University of Himachal Pradesh in the northwest of India. He specializes in issues of social inclusion and exclusion, the sociology of law and social theory in general. He, of course, grew in a context of mixed legal systems, but in which the judicial structure is largely influenced by the common law. But he has bridged the wall of legal cultures as he obtained his PhD in Germany and has, of course, spoken and been in Europe participating in events in several European universities. I thank you in advance for your contribution. I will keep the watch very tightly this time again, and thank you very much for your patience, your students particularly, and your determination to learn this and quietly. Thank you.
Thank you. The title of my paper is The Presence of Women in the British Judiciary, but as many of you will know, there is no such thing as the British Judiciary because we have three jurisdictions in the UK. We have England and Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. And most of what I will be saying today has to do with England and Wales, but is largely equally applicable. A lot of the general themes are equally applicable for Northern Ireland and Scotland. But we do have one UK court. This is it, although this, I have to say, is a rather outdated picture. For some reason, the website, Brenda Hale may tell us why, does not have a more recent photograph. I would like to say a lot has changed. Some of the personnel have certainly changed, but the gender composition has not changed. Brenda Hale remains the only woman on the Supreme Court, as she has been since it was set up in 2009. So I won't be focusing specifically on talking about the Supreme Court. When I was preparing this paper, what struck me was the gap between the astonishing amount of time, energy, and debate that's been devoted in the UK and in England and Wales specifically to the question of diversity in the judiciary, the comparison between that gap and progress in actually changing the composition of the judiciary. When I started to just look through at all the various different investigations, inquiries, reports that there have been in recent years, these were some that I came up with. I've probably missed some, and you'll see particularly in recent years that there have been an increasing number. If I had added in academic work and radio programs and newspaper articles and seminars and lectures and blog entries, the list would have gone on for pages and pages. And some of these debates, these engagements, particularly official ones, have led to very considerable changes in the way in which judges are appointed in England and Wales. The most important structural change was instituted in 2005 as a result of the Constitutional Reform Act of that date, which brought about a root and branch change to the way in which judges are appointed both to the Supreme Court and in England and Wales, setting up judicial appointments commissions. There had already been an equivalent bodies established in Northern Ireland and Scotland, so these are independent bodies which took over essentially from the government the job of appointing the judges. And that started work, the England and Wales Commission, in 2006. It was hoped and expected that the creation of the new commission would impact on the lack of diversity in the judiciary, and indeed a statutory provision in the Constitutional Reform Act requires the commission to have regard to the need to encourage diversity in the range of persons available for selection for appointment. So this is evidence of the fact that concern about lack of diversity was actually a driving force in the creation of this new structural arrangement for appointing judges. The new commission includes lay members, judges and lawyers, and it instituted completely new selection processes, much more formalised, involving job interviews, assessment centres and such like. However, by 2009, there was concern that there had not been any particularly evident immediate progress in appointments or any obvious change in the nature of appointments. And an advisory panel on judicial diversity was established, chaired by a very senior public figure called Baroness Neuberger. And it produced a report the following year, in 2010, which contained 53 recommendations for change intended to increase diversity in the judiciary. One of those recommendations was that there should be a judicial diversity task force set up to oversee the implementation of those 53 recommendations. And that task force is made up of members of the Ministry of Justice, senior lawyers, the Judiciary, Judicial Appointments Commission, and it has reported four times to date. Many of the recommendations have been implemented, and they include a whole range of different changes, such as job shadowing, mentoring, flexible working arrangements, outreach programs, new judicial eligibility rules, the creation of diversity networks, diversity officers, annual reports on progress, improved data recording, greater transparency, and what they called myth-busting campaigns. So a whole lot of activity has gone on. And I was reading the most recent 2013 report of the task force, and I just plucked out of it some of these comments, which were by senior lawyers, judges, members of the Judicial Appointments Commission, etc., just to give you a flavour of the kind of consensus that has formed in England and Wales about the importance of this subject and the need for change. A lot of emphasis on talk about being wholeheartedly supportive, passionate about the need for change, etc. So that raises the question, well, where has all this passionate and wholehearted support for change actually got us in terms of transformation? Well, this shows us the change. You can see that indeed from about 1990, when the debate started, the number of women in the judiciary did start to increase. And you can see in relation to the district bench, which is the top light blue line, that the numbers have increased significantly. They are still very much a minority, but nevertheless there has been some increase. The tribunals, which I haven't put on here because I didn't have the figures to hand, but tribunals are part of the judiciary, likewise have increased even more. But, of course, if you look to the higher ranks, that is the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeal, the High Court, down at the bottom, you'll see that progress has been very slow indeed. This, of course, is a picture that we're starting to get rather familiar with. The judiciary in England and Wales remains largely white, male, and upper middle class, and it's sometimes said it becomes paler, maler, and more socially advantaged the higher up you go. In 2011, a report by a body called the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which looked at women's participation in institutions of power right across the UK, estimated that it would take another 45 years to achieve gender equality in the senior judiciary. So that gives you a sense of the pace of change. And what's very noticeable is that as the consensus support for greater diversity in the judiciary has grown stronger, with a lot of talk about wholehearted passionate support, the ambition in terms of the future rate of progress has actually grown weaker. So if you look at this quote, this was from Lord Taylor, who was the head of the, well, Lord Chief Justice in the 1990s. He stated in 1992 that he was acknowledging the imbalance between men and women, white and black members of the judiciary, and he had no doubt that the balance would be redressed in the next few years. Within 5 years, he said, I would expect to see a substantial number of appointments. This is not just a pious hope, it will be monitored. And there were other senior judges who produced reports around the same time, giving these kind of very clear statements, and politicians likewise. Well, the tone in recent years has actually shifted, and there's less of a sense of urgency, and I think more stress being placed on the idea of identity blind impartiality. So if we look at this quote from Lord Judge, and Judge is actually his name, not his title, rather confusingly, who was Lord Chief Justice in Wales until he retired this year, and he was speaking in 2008 at a conference specifically on equality in the justice system. And the point he made was that it's perfectly obvious that background, ethnicity, religion, sexuality and gender are utterly irrelevant to the ability of an individual to be a good judge. So that's the absolute classic traditional approach. Then went on to say, and therefore they are utterly irrelevant to the selection and appointment of any judge, which I think is a very different statement from those that you have often heard in recent years. And I would like to add another comment, which is more recently, in 2012, Lord Sumption, who is a recently appointed member of the Supreme Court and was previously a member of the Judicial Appointments Commission, a legal member of the Judicial Appointments Commission, gave a lecture on equality and diversity, and he said that he anticipated that it would be, yes, probably about 50 years or so before there was gender equality. And he made this rather interesting comment that, as in this area, as in life generally, we just cannot have everything we want. We have to make choices and accept impure compromises. We may even have to learn patience. So those of you who thought that perhaps we had been rather patient, no, apparently we need to learn patience. The Advisory Panel on Judicial Diversity recently was a little less bleak in its hope that within a decade, by 2020, this was a report in 2010, there should be a much more diverse judiciary at all levels. But when you compare that to Lord Taylor's 1992 commitment to significant change within 5 years, the suggestion that by 2020 there should be much more diversity, this is a pretty limited ambition, particularly bearing in mind the changing composition, the radically changed composition of the legal profession. So what's the explanation for the failure of these early hopes and this downgrading of expectations? Because 40 years ago, when women first entered the legal profession in large numbers, it was expected that they would trickle up to the bench from the judiciary. And this was a very sensible and understandable expectation, given the really remarkable rate of progress that women made into the legal profession from the 1970s, when there were almost none, until the point in the late 90s, when women entering the profession as solicitors were in a majority. And today, even the bar, as I hope most of you know, the legal profession in England and Wales is divided between solicitors and barristers, and the bar, which has tended to be to lag behind, even there, we're talking about 40% plus today. So that expectation was absolutely understandable. Why then, given those figures, has progress been so slow? Well, the important thing to realise is that this is not the appointment pool. This is the appointment pool, particularly to the senior bench. Senior judges in England and Wales are still appointed, that is High Court and above, from a very small group of lawyers, from Queen's Counsel, SILC as they're called, those are elite barristers, and when you look at those figures, you'll see that there has been an astonishing lack of progress, despite the increasing numbers of women joining the bar. The proportion of women appointed SILC still remains, I think, 11% at the moment, with very little evidence of change. Almost all judges are to the High Court and above are appointed from those who have served as part-time, that is, fee-paying judges, and almost all those fee-paying judges are appointed from this group of QCs. And there are many reasons put forward as to why women aren't being appointed as QCs, and I won't go into them because they're all familiar, the same old arguments. But what's interesting to me is why there has been so little debate about why women are still being appointed, or sorry, judges are still being appointed to the senior ranks of the judiciary from this tiny group of lawyers, which essentially excludes the vast majority of even very senior lawyers from the picture, who are working as solicitors, who are working in public life, who are working in a whole array of different legal careers. Well, one explanation is that at the heart of the process, at the heart of our judicial appointments process, is the judiciary. And despite our new system of judicial appointments commissions, the system is largely, one could say, dominated or influenced, depending on which word you prefer to choose, by the judiciary. Under the old system, we had what was called a system of secret soundings, whereby senior judges were asked their views on the suitability of potential appointees. One of the reasons for changing the system was to bring an end to the secret soundings, to increase transparency, to reduce the extent to which judges were appointing judges in their own image. But the reality is that the current system, in which judges sit on the commission, in which judges' views are still very strong through the consultation process — it's a more formal system of refereeing and consultations, but judges and senior barristers, I should say, are very much at the heart of that system — that process still continues. Lay members play a very important role on the commission, but judges, their voices are very strong, and they're particularly strong in relation to the appointments at the higher ranks. What a judge believes to be an appropriate set of skills for a senior judge inevitably carries very considerable weight in the discussion as to who should be appointed. So the senior judiciary and the senior bar from which it's drawn remain deeply committed to homogeneity, both in terms of career pattern and, I have to say, in terms of culture. And I think their position can be summed up as being strongly in favour of greater diversity, and there's no doubt that they are, that there's a lot of talk about that, but strongly in favour of greater diversity as long as the judiciary remains essentially the same. And that's the problem, because greater diversity without difference is not possible. This is a comment by Lord Lloyd, who was in 2003, who was at the time, thank you, I knew someone would appreciate that, who was at the time a former law lord. And he was giving evidence to a select committee, and I was the specialist advisor on the select committee. So I was in the room when he made this comment. We were talking about diversity, and I'm afraid I, like Sally, my response was the same. And there was a certain amount of tittering went on around the room. And Lord Lloyd, perfectly decent, honourable, intelligent man of integrity, had no idea why what he had said was in any way problematic. And I think that in itself says a lot. So for change to come about, for me to finish, one of two things has to happen in the UK, in England, Wales, and indeed Scotland and Northern Ireland. Either the judicial appointments process has got to be radically changed again, and that means removing it from the hands of the judiciary totally, and I suspect re-injecting an element of political involvement in the process, and I have to say that I have completely changed my view on this. I was a very big fan of the Judicial Appointments Commission. I was a very big fan of removing politicians from the process, and I now believe that that was a very serious mistake, because without political will to change, it is very unlikely that there will be change. So that means either re-injecting some political component and reducing or removing the judicial component, and I think that's extremely unlikely given that we have established a whole new system, or, and perhaps some of you may say this is equally unlikely, but one can only hope, the judges, senior judges, have got to accept that diversity without difference just isn't possible. They've got to try to find some way to find merit in qualities which are not identical to their own. If that change doesn't happen, then I think diversity will continue at the sort of snail's pace that we've seen, and we are talking 45, 50, 60 years. Everyone in this room will probably be dead and buried. Our children may even be dead and buried before it happens. The consequence of that is that the legitimacy of the judiciary will suffer, and I think this, I think, is equally serious. The very few women who will be appointed will be those who can mould themselves as closely as possible to that of the traditional candidate. In some ways, I think we need to take seriously Lord Sumption's argument about accepting impure compromise, but not in the way that I think he meant. The kind of impure compromises that I have in mind involve things like a dreaded unspoken word of quotas.